Welcome to episode 4 of Counting to 5, a weekly podcast about the United States Supreme Court. On today's episode, we're going to recap the oral arguments the court heard in three cases this week. We'll take a quick look at three new cases the court has agreed to hear, and we'll consider the court's first opinion of the term. Let's dive right in. This week, the court heard oral argument in three cases, all on Tuesday, October 11th. In last week's episode, I gave an in-depth preview of each of these cases. Now, I'm going to recap the oral arguments, but if you're not already familiar with these cases, I highly recommend you check out Episode 3 to give you the background you need to better understand the issues in play. The first case of the day was Samsung Electronics Co. v. Apple, the case about how to determine damages for the infringement of a design patent. Here, Apple is defending a $399 million verdict it received for Samsung's infringement of Apple's iPhone design patents relating to the shape of the front face of the phone and the layout of icons on the screen. The statute at issue in this case makes someone who sells any article of manufacture to which an infringing design has been applied liable to the owner to the extent of his total profit. If you recall from last episode, I explained that Samsung had two arguments. First, that the phrase total profit could be construed to mean total profit attributable to the infringing design. And second, that the relevant article of manufacture is not the whole phone, but only the component of the phone to which the infringing design was applied. Well, Samsung's counsel, Kathleen Sullivan, began her argument by abandoning the first of these theories and telling the court that Samsung was relying solely on the article of manufacture approach. The result of this concession was that now everyone, Samsung, Apple, and the United States as amicus, was in agreement, first, that there is no apportionment of profits from the infringing article of manufacture, and second, that the infringing article of manufacture may be smaller than the entire phone. Of course, the devil is in the details. With the apportionment argument out of the way, the oral argument focused on two key questions. One, how should the relevant article of manufacture be determined? And two, if the infringing article of manufacture is not the entire consumer product, how do you determine the total profit attributable to that article? On the first question, Samsung's counsel argued that the infringing article of manufacture should be determined primarily by reference to the patent. Here, the patent described a design for the front face of a smartphone, so, according to Samsung, the relevant articles of manufacture are the front faces of Samsung's phones, to which the infringing designs were applied. On the second question, Samsung argued that profits could be attributed to a particular component in proportion to its cost of manufacture, or alternatively, through expert testimony about how much a particular component contributed to profits. During the United States' argument time, the government's counsel, Brian Fletcher, argued for a four-factor test to determine the relevant article of manufacture. First, the scope of the patented design as shown in the patent drawings. Second, how prominently that design features in the product. Third, whether the product contains other conceptually distinct innovations or components not associated with the patented design. And fourth, the physical relationship between the patented design and the rest of the product. The government agreed with Samsung that the profits attributable to a particular component might be based on cost of manufacture or might be determined on the basis of expert testimony about customer demand. The government emphasized, though, that how much an infringing design drives profits is relevant only to the question of how to attribute profits to a particular article of manufacture, and not to the question of what is the relevant article of manufacture in the first place. Apple's counsel, Seth Waxman, agreed that the four factors proposed by the government are relevant to determining the article of manufacture, but wouldn't limit the inquiry to those factors alone. A key point of disagreement was on the relevance of the impact of the infringing design on the demand for the product. Apple took the position that the only appropriate measure of the damages attributable to a particular component was cost of manufacture. According to Apple, attribution of profits on the basis of how much a particular component drove consumer demand would be apportionment, which is not allowed by the statute. Apple argued, therefore, that the effect of a design on consumer demand should be weighed in the initial inquiry about the relevant article of manufacture. On rebuttal, Samsung's counsel countered that the statute's text doesn't forbid all apportionment. It just says not to apportion the value of a particular article attributable to its design. It doesn't bar apportioning the total profit across different component articles of manufacture. In their questioning of all three attorneys, the justices explored both the article of manufacture issue and the profits issue through a series of questions revolving around the distinctive design of the Volkswagen Beetle. If a competitor copied the Beetle's design, is the relevant article of manufacture the body of the car or the entire car? And if it's just the body, how do you determine the total profit? A VW Beetle clearly has numerous valuable features distinct from the body design, for example, the engine and the interior, but at the same time, the Beetle's iconic look is undoubtedly a significant factor in its sales. Samsung and Apple also sharply disagreed about the lower court proceedings in this case. Samsung argued that it repeatedly tried to argue for an article of manufacture smaller than the entire phone, but was prevented from doing so by the district court judge, who considered it a prohibited apportionment argument. Apple, on the other hand, argues that Samsung simply failed to make this argument below, leaving the Supreme Court with no basis to overturn the decision that the entire phones are the relevant articles of manufacture. Justice Breyer suggested that the Supreme Court, after clarifying the correct legal standard, should send this factual issue back for the lower court to sort out. Tuesday's second case was Peña Rodríguez v. Colorado, the case about whether a rule of evidence prohibiting testimony about jury deliberations conflicts with the Sixth Amendment's guarantee of an impartial jury. Peña Rodríguez's counsel, Jeffrey Fisher, was questioned almost immediately by Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Alito about how far his proposed rule would extend. For example, would it require allowing inquiry into bias on the basis of other identity-based categories, such as religion, gender, or sexual orientation? Peña Rodríguez's counsel resisted these questions, focusing instead on the distinctly pernicious nature of racial bias and urging the court to leave the issue of other forms of bias for future cases. When pressed further on this point by Justice Breyer and then Justice Sotomayor, Peña Rodríguez's counsel pointed to two other areas related to juries where the court has treated race as special without significant expansion into other areas: the right to question potential jurors about bias, and so-called Batson challenges, where a party can contest the elimination of potential jurors on race-based grounds. Chief Justice Roberts drew a distinction between the protection provided by the Equal Protection Clause, under which differential treatment according to race or other so-called suspect classifications is given increased scrutiny, and the Sixth Amendment, which by its terms guarantees an impartial jury without regard to the source or type of bias. But Justice Sotomayor pushed back, suggesting that equal protection values should inform the court's interpretation of the impartial jury guarantee. Peña Rodríguez's counsel seized on this suggestion and returned to it repeatedly throughout the argument. Counsel for Peña Rodríguez also explained that he was not arguing that race-based bias was necessarily worse than other forms of bias in a particular case, but that racial bias is particularly difficult to root out through other means. Counsel for Peña Rodríguez also argued that there are 20 jurisdictions, 18 states and 2 federal circuits, that currently allow the use of juror testimony about racial bias in deliberations, and these jurisdictions have not seen a broad expansion of this exception to jury secrecy. Under questioning from the justices about how this exception would be implemented in practice, Peña Rodríguez's counsel explained that courts that have dealt with this have adopted an objective test for bias that doesn't depend on the subjective effect on individual jurors, but that the lower courts are divided on whether they can look to the strength of the prosecution's case to determine whether the bias likely affected the verdict. He suggested that there was no need for the court to answer that second question in this case. Counsel for Colorado, Frederick Yarger, argued against treating race as a special case, saying that addressing some forms of bias while turning a blind eye to others is hard to square with the Sixth Amendment, which provides a broadly applicable individual right to an impartial jury. Colorado also challenged Peña Rodríguez's claim that there are 20 jurisdictions that carve out an exception for racial bias. According to Colorado, there are really only 6 jurisdictions with this rule, and, although these jurisdictions have dealt with cases of racial bias, the rule they use actually applies to all forms of bias. Colorado also argued that there have been abuses in these jurisdictions, with attorneys ginning up unfounded claims of bias as an excuse to engage in a fishing expedition into jury deliberations. The United States, participating as an amicus in support of Colorado, was represented by Rachel Kovner. Under questioning from Justice Kagan, the government challenged the idea that the right to question potential jurors and Batson challenges to racially motivated juror elimination provide a precedent for special treatment of race under the Sixth Amendment. The government argued that although the juror questioning cases involved race, the actual rule was that counsel must be allowed to inquire about forms of bias that are likely to be relevant, and the Batson challenges are specific to the equal protection context. The government also insisted that the court must consider other potential safeguards that are available to protect against jury bias. The government also distinguished jurors reporting bias mid-trial, which can reveal bias that had an immediate impact on another juror, versus post-trial inquiry, which will involve after-the-fact reinterpretation and second-guessing. On rebuttal, Justice Alito once again pressed Peña Rodríguez's counsel to answer whether the rule he proposes would apply to other forms of bias beyond racial bias. Peña Rodríguez's counsel suggested that defendants would not be able to inquire into forms of bias that would be given minimal protection under equal protection law, but refused to commit with respect to other protected classifications such as gender or religion. Under friendly prompting from Justice Kagan, Peña Rodríguez's counsel concluded by emphasizing the unique significance of racial bias. Tuesday's third and final oral argument was in Manrique v. United States. This case revolves around a technical question of appellate procedure, whether a criminal defendant who appeals a judgment of conviction that defers determination of restitution to the victim of the crime must file a separate notice of appeal after an amended judgment is entered setting the amount of restitution. Counsel for Manrique, Paul Rashkin, began by arguing that the initial judgment deferring determination of restitution and the later amended judgment setting restitution should be considered a single judgment requiring only a single notice of appeal. In response to a question from Justice Kagan, Manrique's counsel affirmed that he is relying both on the essential unity of the two judgments and on Rule 4b-2 of the Federal Rules of Appellate Procedure. In response to a later question from Justice Kagan, however, he argued that Manrique should win even if Rule 4b-2 doesn't apply, because the rules uniformly anticipate only a single notice of appeal. Rule 4b-2 says that a notice of appeal filed after the court announces a decision, sentence, or order, but before the entry of the judgment or order, is treated as filed on the date of and after the entry. Chief Justice Roberts questioned whether this rule applies by its own terms, since Manrique's notice of appeal was filed before, not after, the court announced the amount of restitution. Manrique's counsel answered that the original judgment, which said that some restitution would be awarded, was enough. Chief Justice Roberts questioned whether Manrique's counsel was trying to have it both ways, treating the original judgment as both a final judgment and therefore immediately appealable, and also non-final, awaiting its completion by the later amended judgment. Justices Sotomayor and Breyer both challenged Manrique's counsel, suggesting that requiring defendants to file a second notice of appeal after the judgment setting restitution would actually be a much simpler, easier-to-follow rule. The United States was represented by Alan Keedham. During the government's argument, Justice Sotomayor brought up Federal Rule of Criminal Procedure 32J, which requires the court to inform a criminal defendant after sentencing of the right to appeal the sentence. The government acknowledged that although the district court provided this notice at the initial sentencing, it did not do so, but should have, at the restitution hearing. The government argued, however, that the court's error doesn't cure the defendant's failure to file a new notice of appeal, but rather the established remedy for the court's failure to provide the required notice is for the defendant to file a habeas corpus petition. The government argued that under Manrique's approach, a defendant who wanted to appeal the initial conviction and sentence could have his appeal held up waiting for the judgment's completion through the later restitution order. In opposition to Manrique's argument that the rules uniformly require only a single notice of appeal, the government pointed to several notices where a second notice is required, including when a defendant has made a motion to correct a sentence and wants to appeal the decision on that motion, when a sentence has been altered to account for the defendant's cooperation and the defendant wants to appeal the alteration, and, perhaps most directly on point, when a restitution order is later modified after a victim comes forth with evidence of new losses. And, under questioning from the Chief Justice, the government noted that Manrique's situation is the same as a civil defendant who is liable for the plaintiff's attorney's fees. Even if the defendant appeals the original judgment, saying that the plaintiff is entitled to attorney's fees in an amount to be determined later, the defendant needs to file another notice of appeal after the amount of attorney's fees is established. In addition to hearing oral arguments in those three cases, the court also issued its first opinion of the term in a case called Boss v. Oklahoma. This was a per curiam summary reversal. Let me break down what that means. The cases we've been primarily focusing on, the cases that everybody thinks about when they hear about the Supreme Court, are what's referred to as the court's merits docket. Here's how the merits docket works in the ordinary case. A party who loses in the lower courts files a formal request for the Supreme Court to hear its case, called a petition for a writ of certiorari, cert petition for short. The court gets somewhere in the ballpark of 7,000 to 8,000 petitions a year, and in recent years has agreed to hear about 70 cases, give or take. The court's decision to grant a cert petition is entirely discretionary, but everyone agrees, and Rule 10 of the court's own rules says, that the most important criterion is whether there have been conflicting rulings by lower courts, either the Federal Circuit Courts of Appeals or State Supreme Courts. This is referred to as a circuit split. The justices often say that the Supreme Court is not a court of error correction. That is, unlike most appellate courts, including the Federal Circuit Courts, it's not the Supreme Court's job to double-check the work of lower courts and make sure they're getting it right. Instead, the Supreme Court sees its job as resolving important open legal questions and ensuring national uniformity of federal law. The cases the court accepts into its merits docket reflect this focus. In addition to the merits docket, the court occasionally acts on cases in other ways. On a previous episode, we mentioned the court's practice of granting, vacating, and remanding, or GVRing, cases, which basically sends them back to the lower court for another look, usually in response to a recent Supreme Court decision that changed the state of the law. Another tool the court has at its disposal is the summary reversal. This is where the court grants a cert petition, but instead of scheduling the case for oral argument and getting full briefing, the court immediately issues an opinion reversing the lower court decision. Summary reversals are normally per curiam opinions, which means that the opinion is designated as by the court rather than being authored by a specific individual justice. And they're usually pretty short. Summary reversals are a rare example of the Supreme Court engaging in error correction, perhaps to rein in a lower court that the Supreme Court thinks is out of line with its precedents. In the last 10 years, the court's summary reversal numbers have been all over the map, from a low of 2 in 2007 to a high of 14 in 2009. Boss v. Oklahoma involves the use of victim impact statements in capital sentencing hearings. In a 1987 case called Booth v. Maryland, the Supreme Court said that the Eighth Amendment's prohibition on cruel and unusual punishment prohibits the use of certain types of victim impact statements at capital sentencing hearings, including a victim's family member's opinions about the appropriate punishment for the crime. Then, in a 1991 case, Payne v. Tennessee, the court partially overruled Booth v. Maryland, saying that victim impact statements focusing on the victim and the impact of the crime on family members were permissible. But the court expressly said that it wasn't reconsidering victim statements about the appropriate punishment because those weren't at issue in Payne. Boss v. Oklahoma involves the capital sentencing of Sean Michael Boss, who was convicted of a triple murder. During his sentencing hearing, three of the victim's family members testified recommending a death sentence, and the jury did sentence Boss to death. The Oklahoma Court of Criminal Appeals, Oklahoma's highest court for criminal cases, decided that even though the Supreme Court's Payne case didn't expressly overrule Booth on the issue of victim impact statements recommending death, Payne, through its reasoning, implicitly overruled Booth, and therefore Booth's prohibition on this type of testimony was no longer binding. The Supreme Court reversed, telling the Oklahoma Court of Criminal Appeals that, quote, it is this court's prerogative alone to overrule one of its precedents, and, quote, our decisions remain binding precedent until we see fit to reconsider them, regardless of whether subsequent cases have raised doubts about their continuing vitality. Justice Thomas filed a single-paragraph concurring opinion, joined by Justice Alito, emphasizing that the court's opinion doesn't say that Booth is correct or that it shouldn't be overruled, but only that it hasn't yet been overruled. In vacating the decision below, Thomas writes, this court says nothing about whether Booth was correctly decided or whether Payne swept away its analytical foundations. In this concurrence, Thomas and Alito warn against overreading the per curiam as endorsing Booth, but they also signal to attorneys that at least two members of the court are open to reconsidering and potentially overruling Booth in an appropriate future case. The court also issued several additional orders on Tuesday. First, the court issued an orders list Tuesday morning. This orders list included the Boss v. Oklahoma decision that we already discussed, but it also included denials of certiorari in around 200 cases and various additional orders. The court granted, vacated, and remanded three cases for further consideration by the lower courts, and the court granted leave for the Solicitor General to participate as an amicus in oral arguments in two more cases, Star Athletica v. Varsity Brands, the case about copyrights on cheerleading uniforms that will be argued on October 31st, and State Farm Fire and Casualty Co. v. United States ex rel. Rigsby, a case about the requirement that False Claims Act cases be filed under seal that will be argued on November 1st. Then, on Tuesday afternoon, the court issued an additional miscellaneous order granting certiorari in three new cases. Let's take a quick look at each of these. The first grant, Hernandez v. Mesa, involves the cross-border shooting of an unarmed Mexican teenager by a U.S. Border Patrol agent. The teen's parents sued the Border Patrol agent for violating his constitutional rights, and the case involves several issues relating to whether their lawsuit will be allowed to proceed. One question involves whether the parents can bring the lawsuit at all. The Supreme Court held in a 1971 decision called Bivens v. Six Unknown Named Agents that in certain circumstances, people can bring actions for money damages against federal officials for violations of constitutional rights, even when there is no federal statute allowing such a suit. In several later cases, the court has been reluctant to allow so-called Bivens actions for additional types of constitutional claims. So the court needs to decide if the lawsuit can even go forward in the first place. Another question at issue is whether the Constitution even provides protection to someone in this situation, a non-U.S. citizen standing on foreign soil. And third, the court will consider the question of qualified immunity, whether uncertainty about the scope of the Constitution's protection immunizes the agent from liability for money damages. The second case granted is actually three closely related cases that have been consolidated. They are Ziegler v. Turkman, Ashcroft v. Turkman, and Hasty v. Turkman. These three cases arise out of the arrest and detention, allegedly in severe conditions, of Arab and Muslim non-citizens following the attacks of September 11, 2001. Several of these individuals filed suit against high-ranking government officials, including former Attorney General John Ashcroft, alleging violations of their constitutional rights. This case involves three major questions. First, as in Hernandez v. Mesa, this case asks whether a Bivens action can be brought raising this type of constitutional claim. Second, are the officials protected from liability by the doctrine of qualified immunity? A government official is immune from a suit for damages when the constitutional rights at issue were not clearly established at the time they were allegedly violated. And the third issue is a technical question about pleading, that is, what specifically a plaintiff needs to allege in order to have a viable claim. In a 2009 case, Ashcroft v. Iqbal, the court held that factual allegations need to plausibly support legal liability without requiring speculative inferences. The government officials argued that this standard isn't met here. Importantly, both Justices Sotomayor and Kagan are recused from this case, presumably due to their involvement at an earlier stage in their roles as a Second Circuit Court of Appeals judge and the Solicitor General, respectively. This leaves the court with only 6 justices hearing the case, or 7 if a new member is appointed in time, meaning that victory in this case requires only counting to 4 instead of the usual 5. The third case the court has granted is Midland Funding v. Johnson. This is a case about the interaction between the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act, the FDCPA, and bankruptcy proceedings. Specifically, it asks whether it is a violation of the FDCPA to file a proof of claim in bankruptcy proceedings for a debt that is beyond the statute of limitations. These 3 grants bring the court's total up to 40 cases for the term so far. Finally, on Friday, the court issued a revised calendar for the November oral argument sitting, which begins on Monday, October 31st. The only change from the previously published calendar is the removal of Ivy v. Morath, which was originally scheduled for argument on Monday, November 7th. The court didn't explain why Ivy was dropped from the calendar, but observers speculate that it may be due to what is sometimes referred to as a vehicle problem. The Supreme Court takes cases to resolve a particular legal issue. Sometimes a case involves an important issue that the court is interested in deciding, but the case also has procedural or jurisdictional complications that may make it difficult or impossible for the court to reach the issue it wants to decide. To avoid having to deal with these complications, one of the court's considerations in taking a case is whether the case is a good vehicle for deciding the important legal issue. That is, does it present the issue relatively cleanly without excessive complications? Ivy v. Morath involves a challenge under the Americans with Disabilities Act by 5 hearing-impaired Texas residents to Texas's system of providing driver education classes. In a brief filed on September 29th, Texas represented that each of the 5 plaintiffs had now either successfully completed a driver education program or had moved out of state, making the case moot. A case is moot when a court is no longer able to provide relief to the plaintiffs, and if it is moot, the case must be dismissed because there's no longer a case or controversy over which the court has jurisdiction. If the court is concerned about mootness, then it may dig the case. This stands for dismiss as improvidently granted, and the court digs a case when it decides it was a mistake to take it in the first place. Next week looks like it will be a quiet week at the court. The court is expected to issue orders Monday from its October 14th conference, but other than that, there is nothing on the calendar. There have been no major new developments with respect to the court's open seat, but there have been a few public statements of interest. The second presidential debate, unlike the first, included a brief appearance by the Supreme Court. In response to a question about the Supreme Court, Hillary Clinton expressed her regret that the Senate has not acted on President Obama's nomination of Merrick Garland, describing the Senate's inaction as a dereliction of duty. But Clinton avoided actually endorsing Garland and didn't even refer to him by name. Clinton also briefly discussed what she's looking for in a justice, specifically naming Citizens United as a case that she wants to see reversed, and saying that she wants a court that will stick with Roe v. Wade and stick with marriage equality. She also criticized the list of candidates put forth by Donald Trump as including people who would overturn Roe v. Wade. Donald Trump said that he wanted to appoint justices in the mold of the late Justice Scalia and referenced his previously floated list of candidates, whom he described as well-respected. Trump also stated that he wants judges who respect the Second Amendment. Chris Wallace, who will be moderating the third presidential debate on October 19th, announced this week that the Supreme Court is one of 6 topics selected for a 15-minute segment of the debate, so we can expect a lot more from the candidates this week. It has now been over 210 days since Merrick Garland's nomination, and it's clear that nothing will happen at least until after the election. There had been a lot of speculation, however, that following a Clinton victory, the Republican-led Senate might move during the lame duck session to confirm Garland rather than risk Clinton nominating someone they would like even less. This week, Senator Mike Lee cast doubt on this idea, saying that he did not perceive a significant difference between Merrick Garland and other candidates Clinton might be expected to nominate. This past week, Justice Ginsburg made the rounds on interview shows promoting her new book, My Own Words. Ginsburg was interviewed by Jane Pauley on CBS Sunday Morning, by Katie Couric on Yahoo Global News, by Gwen Ifill on PBS NewsHour, and on The Charlie Rose Show. Ginsburg's comments in the Katie Couric interview received a great deal of attention after she criticized San Francisco 49ers quarterback Colin Kaepernick's national anthem protest against police treatment of African Americans. In a span of a few moments, Ginsburg characterized the protests as dumb, disrespectful, terrible, ridiculous, stupid, and arrogant. This led to criticism from supporters of Kaepernick and the protests against police brutality generally. An article by Mark Joseph Stern at Slate is illustrative of these critiques, arguing that Ginsburg is, quote, a wealthy high society opera lover whose progressive intellectual ideals are increasingly disconnected from today's new civil rights movement, and that, quote, Ginsburg supports minority rights without necessarily supporting the minority activists who work today to make those rights a reality. Then on Friday, Justice Ginsburg walked back her comments, issuing a statement to the press which said, quote, "Barely aware of the incident or its purpose, my comments were inappropriately dismissive and harsh. I should have declined to respond." This is the second time in recent months that Justice Ginsburg has publicly backtracked after controversial comments. On July 14th, she issued a statement expressing regret for what she called ill-advised remarks about Donald Trump during several interviews. This coming week looks to be a relatively quiet one for the justices. Justice Sotomayor will be giving a lecture at the University of Minnesota on Monday, October 17th, and on Thursday, October 20th, Justice Alito will be appearing at the University of Buffalo School of Law for a question and answer session. I want to flag one interesting lower court opinion from the past week that relates directly to the Supreme Court. On October 11th, Judge Boasberg of the U.S. District Court for the District of Columbia issued an opinion in a case called Shapiro v. Department of Justice. First, a little background. In 2014, Harvard Law professor Richard Lazarus published a law review article exploring the Supreme Court's until then basically unknown and invisible practice of revising opinions after their original issuance. Often these revisions were minor typographical or grammatical errors, but Lazarus found that on occasion the court silently made significant substantive revisions to his opinions with no explanation or transparency. This article led directly to changes in the court's procedures, and now, whenever the court modifies an opinion after its original issuance, the revision is noted prominently on the court's website, along with a document highlighting the differences between versions. The Shapiro v. Department of Justice lawsuit involves a Freedom of Information Act request filed with the Department of Justice requesting records relating to the Supreme Court's revised opinions. Although the subject of this decision is a litigation discovery dispute, the opinion refers in passing to the Solicitor General's occasional practice of calling or writing to the court to suggest changes to published opinions, and provides an interesting look at one aspect of the relationship between the court and the Office of the Solicitor General. And that's it for Episode 4. Links to many of the articles, videos, orders, transcripts, and other resources discussed in this episode can be found in the show notes at countingto5.com. That's T-O and the number 5. I've also included links and more information about a few Supreme Court-related panel discussions in the past week that are now available online, and information about an additional event coming up this week. As always, if you have any thoughts or suggestions about the podcast, I would love to hear your feedback. Leave a comment on the show notes post at countingto5.com or on the Counting to 5 Facebook page, tweet at countingto5, or send an email to mike@countingto5.com. I look forward to hearing from you. Tell me what you liked, what you didn't, what's missing, and how we could do better going forward. This podcast is still very much a work in progress, and your feedback will help guide it as it continues to evolve. If you've enjoyed this episode, please spread the word. Tell your friends, share it on Facebook or Twitter, and please consider rating and reviewing the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you subscribe to or download podcasts. And if you want to help ensure that this podcast continues, please consider becoming a patron. Visit Counting to Five's Patreon page, and for as little as $1 a month, you can help keep this podcast going. Please join me again next week for another episode. The court's next oral argument sitting doesn't begin until October 31st, so next week we're going to do something a little different. In honor of the recent publication of Justice Ginsburg's book, My Own Words, we're going to take a deeper dive into Justice Ginsburg's life and work on the court by looking at several recent books about the justice. I hope you'll join me. Thank you for listening. This has been Counting to Five.